Hi, this is Circe Olson-Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, E Pluribus Unum. I'm speaking with Valerie Bonham Moon, who is our writer in residence through the end of the year, and she's done two projects with the museum, and we're so excited to have you back again. Hey, Valerie.
Hi there, Circe. Good to be talking to you.
So let's just jump right in. I know you're a brat and you're a veteran and you're a military spouse. Are you a military mom too?
Yes, my oldest son was an Apache helicopter crew chief, and he served with the Big Red One in Desert Shield and Desert Storm.
Huh, that's interesting. Both my father and my son were Big Red One out of Fort Riley, Kansas. It's a small
right?
World. Yeah. Well, hey, cool. Let's start by telling our listeners a little bit about your brathood. What childhood memories stand out to you?
At the time, I didn't think of my life as military. It was just normal. Mm-hmm. Until I was in 10th grade, just about all the kids I knew were on base. And as far as memories go, in England, when I was little, it was rain and bird song. In South Dakota, it was a tragedy. KC-135, with 44 men on board, going from Ellsworth Air Force Base to Fairchild Air Force Base, mm-hmm. crashed into Mount Kit Carson. Mm-hmm. Two of our neighbors, one across the street and one behind us, were killed, and classmates lost their dads. And so that was an unpleasant thing. Bermuda, when we lived there, that was the experience of water, just so much water. And I loved it. And so many blues. Mm-hmm. Bermuda is just blue, except for the pink beaches. And then the last place I lived as a brat, mm-hmm. Richard Skibauer Air Force Base in Missouri, mm-hmm. was where I encountered civilian kids en masse. There were more of them than there were of us.
Well, we're going to talk about those civilian kids in a second, but I wanted to ask you a weird question first. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some portrayals in movies about how military families are run. And a couple of weeks ago, Shannon Hyde, you know, our student liaison, and I were talking about it on his podcast. Did your dad run your household like a military camp, or did he have like super high standards for you and your siblings?
That's a hard one, because up until I was 50, I lived in military environments, so I didn't know which way was what. Mm-hmm. We all had to toe the line concerning how the house and yard looked outside. Mm-hmm. And there was always the "don't get your dad in trouble" warning.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
But everyone had those. And I think dad had enough military stuff mm-hmm. in the rest of his life that home was a place to relax. And so up until his job was taken over by technology, he was an Air Force photographer. Mm-hmm. And Xerox machines replaced the photocopying. Polaroids replaced the ID card photos that he mm-hmm. took with an actual camera. Mm-hmm. And satellites replaced a lot of aerial photography. And so since dad's career was as a photographer at home, most of what we kids did was being photographic models.
Well, that's cool. You know, every once in a while I'm asked to submit a headshot, and boy, I wish I had a photographer in the family, because headshots are not my thing.
Oh, I had so many headshots as a kid. I can document everything from day one to a lot longer than that.
So you mentioned civilian kids, and that was a question I was going to ask. So you said at your last base there that you had more civilian kids than military kids. So did you know them? I mean, were you friends with them? And what was the differences between your life and their lives if you didn't know them?
Well, before I was at the civilian high school, mm-hmm. There were so few civilian kids in my grade that I knew them by name. There were three of them, Marilyn and Alan and Judy. And mm-hmm. they were the kids who rode the yellow school bus as a differentiated from the blue Air Force shuttle buses. And there must have been more civilian kids at school because they weren't the only three kids on the bus. And as a kid, civilian life baffled me. Mm-hmm. And despite seeing the civilian infrastructure in Rapid City, 10 miles away, mm-hmm. which I didn't visit very often, so I had no idea how civilian life was arranged and who assigned the families their houses and what clubs did they go to and how were they socially segregated, you know, enlisted in officer.
Oh, yeah.
And did their dads work until 30 years or not? And so it was all a big mystery to me.
Well, yeah, we like to try to see where we have intersections and not. So I like the bus thing. That was kind of cool. They were on the yellow bus. You were on the blue bus.
Yep.
So I know you joined the military. We've talked about this before, but when was that and why did you join?
The why is to quote my sister who enlisted in the Air Force. It was the family business because dad was career, mom had been a whack, and we grew up in the military and not having a handle on civilian life, you know, military was the way to go. And I have to give a shout out to my sister as the first woman to be an Air Force Arabic linguist.
Wow, so, really? Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
And my brother enlisted in the Navy, but he wasn't a linguist of any sort. Mm-hmm. And my brother and I were both Vietnam era veterans. That's the when. Mm-hmm. And my sister missed that by about a year. Mm-hmm. And so she came in just after Vietnam. So she did not get a National Defense Service Medal.
So, but she can speak two languages, so.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, so was that right out of high school for you, or did you go to college first and then go, or?
It was the day after I was 18.
Oh, wow. I was just like, wow. So did being a brat help your transition into the military? Did it make it easier or harder, or what do you think?
Well, I did have a bit of a culture shock going from Air Force to the Army, you know, all the terms, you know, I grew up with squadrons and bomb wings, and all of a sudden it was battalions and brigades. Mm-hmm. But I had grown up with photo albums full of pictures of my parents in the Army. Mm-hmm. And so choosing a different service wasn't quite so much a rebellion, you know, where you do something different from your parents,
right?
But it was an adventure.
So your parents were Army and then your dad went over to the Air Force then?
Yeah, he and mom were both Army and then Army Air Corps. And that transitioned over to Air Force.
Oh, that's cool. So once you were in the military and you figured out what the difference between a battalion and a squadron was and stuff, did you feel like you were part of the military community? And if so, how did you know you were a part of this community?
Well, it took a while.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of like, as Americans, you know, we all feel like we're Americans, mm-hmm. but it was kind of like moving from, say, Alabama to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody still speaks English, you still have the same TV programs and everything, but it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the mess hall still had Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners with those neat milk machines. And I knew how to do all the hospital stuff, getting all the shots that a lot of the civilian kids were not used to.
Mm-hmm.
I knew how to show my ID card at the PX, ride shuttle buses. So all of that was the same, but with a different vocabulary.
Huh. So what was your MOS and how long were you in?
I was in for just the one enlistment. And as for my MOS, I was trained as a teletype operator. But when I got my permanent party assignment, it was to an installation without teletype operator, military teletype operators in the comm center. And so I wound up in personnel because I could type. And personnel always picked off the typists who came in unassigned. And so that's where that went. And malassignment was sort of typical for the middle of the Vietnam era because of the one-year rotations in and out of country for the soldiers going over there. And even if you weren't sent to Vietnam, which very few women were, the whole system was in flux because of it.
So it was normal to be wrongly assigned, is what you're saying. It was just kind of, you know, this FUBAR.
Yes. Yes. And a lot of the veterans groups, that's what you hear is, yeah, I was trained as this and got sent, you know, even in languages. A friend of ours, he went to school for Czech language, and they assigned him to a linguist position in Germany.
Wow.
Yeah, so that made no sense. Luckily, he already spoke German, so he did okay. But
wow. Yeah, wow. It was kind of like when my husband and we talked about going to Korea, and it looked like all the assignments available were Korea. So he volunteered for Korea and they sent him to Maryland.
Yeah.
So hey, so you transitioned out of the, you only stayed for this one enlistment. So was it hard transitioning from service member to civilian and then to military spouse, or how'd that go?
Well, I was never a civilian. My husband's unit was just down the street from the WAC detachment. And that's how we met. Uh-huh. And so after I got out, I just changed ID card colors.
Very convenient.
Yes.
So here's a question I've been thinking about for a little bit. And I'd like to hear your take on it. What are the differences between the military brat community, the veteran community, and the spouse community? And is there a difference? And if that's too complicated to understand, or I haven't phrased it right, let me rephrase it. I guess, what are the differences within the communities and then compared to the other communities?
I've noticed definite differences in looking at the online groups. Mm-mm. And the brat community seems to be mostly about memories and the culture shock of losing your military identity when you turn 18. But I think this applies only to the people who seek out their brat connections afterwards. Mm-hmm. I have brat friends from high school who made a seamless transition to civilian life, and now they don't even make any references to the military. And now the spouse community is all about managing military life. Mm-hmm. Where do I go for this? How do I access that? How do I handle separations? And online, it's very much a helper community.
Right.
People asking questions and other people cluing them in.
Mm-hmm.
And the veteran community is a combination of the two, but again, probably self-selected. Mm-hmm. And the questions are mostly about dealing with the VA.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, navigating that, and the people who have more experience helping out the people with less experience. And the memory part is very often photos of their active duty time. And filling in between those are current photos of veteran group activities, honor guards, and honor flights. But between them all, the common denominator is obviously military, but each one approaches the life from a different viewpoint.
So we're talking about community, and I kind of just wanted to stay on that theme for this podcast in a way. Your essay in the museum's book, E Pluribus Unum, We All Shared the Same Supply Chain, is all about community. And so I wanted to ask you if you could read us a little snippet of your essay.
Okay, this is We all shared the same supply train from E Pluribus Unum, a publication of the Museum of the American Military Family. Okay, and this is just the ending pretty much.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I thought my mom's cooking was special to our family. Chuck roast with brown potatoes and roasted carrots, pork chops and pan gravy, fried chicken with mashed potatoes. Unique, right? Unique, no. Still, I thought our suppers were special, even though my mom shopped with all the other moms at the same commissary on the same almost remote Air Force base where we lived. This is so true that in one Facebook brat group, I saw a photo of the payday line in a commissary. It was taken by my photo lab NCOIC dad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I recognized his handwriting on the photo because the practice he had was that he continued with our family photos is to write in information on the print. And so what a thrill it was to see an unknown Rembrandt of my dad's work. On payday, the commissary was the place to be. In reading foodie Facebook comments from other former military kids, their families usually had much the same food that my family ate. Like I said, everyone shopped at the commissary. Naturally, civilians liked their food too. The subscribers on a local city Facebook group about Remember When discuss food from the days of yore served up in long gone dining establishments. Remember the burgers at such and such a place? So many likes. How about the roasted chicken at another place? A lot of likes. People like to eat.
Mm-hmm.
One food dish on veteran and brat lists, like the northerly return of robins in the spring or the turning of leaves in the autumn, will come around in its own season. The iconic dish, one dish that almost universally guarantees a reaction. SOS.
Oh dear.
Love it or hate it, SOS was on everyone's menu, probably even the spouses. SOS, the uninitiated might ask, who is signaling for help at supper? SOS is creamed hamburger on toast or chipped beef on toast or a possible culinary relative of biscuits and gravy. Whatever the meat covered in cream is, the dish is descriptively, if inelegantly known in the military, and here's a pearl clutch alert.
Yep.
Shit on a shingle.
You can't say that.
SOS.
SOS.
Yes. Every one of the self-selected responders from various groups seems to have encountered this dish. Everyone also seems to have an opinion. Full disclosure on everyone. This is the same everyone in that great undocumented demographic, they, as in they say. I haven't polled all of the brats or veterans groups, but this seems to be the majority. Brat responses seem to be equally divided on whether families serve the hamburger version of SOS or the chipped beef version. This divide may be service connected. Navy and Marine comments seem fewer than Army and Air Force responses, so my memory of their reactions is dim. In the dominant chat groups to which I'm subscribed, the divide seems to be Army hamburger and Air Force chipped beef. My heritage is Air Force. My family is in the chipped beef group. On veterans lists, most of the people commenting on SOS refer to a mess hall dining facility version, the hamburger option. When I was regularly dining in an Army mess hall, Company B's where I was stationed, the WAC detachment did not have its own mess hall. The hamburger version was on the menu. In the chow line, I did not recognize that food or the name. SOS, my line colleagues told me. Unbeguiled by the steam tray dish's appearance, man, it looked gross. Mm. I chose no thanks. Still, my Air Force childhood meals of chipped beef on toast fall within the SOS universe. So back to community and its meaning, among the geographically co-located mission-focused people making up most of the military services, I can say with some confidence that a common bond in the American military community, SOS, hinges on the same shared heritage and the same supply line.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting that you chose SOS to give us an example for community. I never would have thought of that. What made you decide to write about SOS?
Well, in my experience, everyone in the military, at least in the Army and Air Force, had an SOS story. I don't know what the galleys serve on Navy ships. My brother didn't really talk about that. But this particular dish seems to be a common denominator.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have to tell you, I like them both, you know, the hamburger and the chip beef one. But I guess if I had to pick one, I would pick the chip beef rather than the hamburger, because the hamburger is a little bit heavy and bland and kind of like lumps of lumps of lumps. But yes. if I had to choose between chip beef and biscuits and gravy, I would be a little hard pressed to choose which is better. Anything in gravy is just awesome. So it would be hard. What about you? Biscuits and gravy or chip beef?
Definitely chip beef. I really didn't encounter biscuits and gravy until after my husband retired from federal service. Mm. And my mom never made biscuits and gravy. So my biscuits are more of the English tea time scones and jam.
Okay, since you're originally from the Air Force chip beef community, I have a recipe question. So do you soak your chip beef in water for a while before you make the SOS? I always did because it was so salty.
Oh, definitely, every time. Otherwise, like you say, way too salty.
Yeah. So what other shared experiences do you think the whole military community has in common?
Communal life, stratification within that life, and maybe a sense of history. All those seem to be common. Mm-hmm. We all usually live together at some point on installations. Mm-hmm. And the stratification between the ranks gives us a sense of knowing where we stand, whether we like that place we're standing or not. Mm-hmm. With uniforms, our place is never in question. You always know where you are in that pecking order. Uh-huh. And the history, the military job, always hinges on something of national or international interest. Mm-hmm. Now, the job itself may appear to be nitinoi, typists, for example, such as I wound up being, who were often called Remington Rangers. Now, I don't know if this disparagement name has changed since the advent of everyone typing on some kind of computer, but without each and every job, the mission would not be accomplished. The most common experience, I think, though, encompassing everyone is moving. Yeah. Whether you're moving from your initial training assignment to a school, or dealing with a terminal assignment before ETSing or retirement, everyone moves.
Yeah.
I imagine that, yeah, we do. I imagine we all have some kind of reaction to the smell of cardboard boxes.
That's true. A brat named Valerie, ironically, Valerie Whiting wrote an essay about boxes and how she just is partial to boxes because she grew up as a brat. Well, moving is definitely something we all understand and can relate to, you know, this moving experience. So I wanted to ask you, what has been the best military community experience you've ever experienced? Boy, that's not well written. What was the worst and why? So the best community experience and the worst community experience.
Okay, I'm starting with the worst, okay. But it still sticks in my mind. It was a guest house at Fort Campbell when we left. Uh-huh. We'd only been there 6 months. Vietnam was winding down with the Paris Peace Accords, but still wasn't over. So the assignment system there was still kind of mishmash. Uh-huh. And we were leaving and we checked into the cheap guest house. Uh-huh. Perhaps the good one was full. I don't know. Uh-huh. 50 cents a night, which even then was dirt cheap.
Yeah.
But wow. But there was a reason for it. Bugs.
Who?
We got into that room and some big bug ran across the floor. I don't even think we'd set down our suitcases. Then one ran across the ceiling. Then we all ran out and found a motel, even though it cost a whole lot more than the guest house. So that was the worst one.
Before you go on, that just made me think, we live here in the tropics here in Hawaii.
Right.
I was doing a podcast the other day and I'm not fond of bugs. And right across my computer, this great big something just.
Oh, good Lord.
I was right in the middle of talking to somebody and there's this pause on the podcast where I'm like, I want to scream, I want to do something, but I'm broadcasting and I can't. So there's this like, the something just kept walking and vanished. So he's still here somewhere. So I can relate. So what was the best? I'm sorry, I hogged your story.
That's okay. Okay, the best community experiences are a toss-up between Bermuda and Munich, Germany.
Mm.
And Bermuda is just beautiful. So many shades of blue.
Mm-mm.
Now, there are downsides such as hurricanes and bugs. Mm. If you live on St. David's Island, there are centipedes. And we're not talking inch-long centipedes or two-inch-long centipedes or even 3-inch-long centipedes.
Mm-hmm.
The longest one I ever saw was in a parking lot. Had been driven over by a car, and I want to say it was 2 feet long.
But it
couldn't have been that long. But it was at least a foot and maybe close to 18 inches. It was one big centipede.
Wow. All right.
Yes. So I know what you mean about the bugs. Yeah. And
the biggest thing I've seen here has been about 3 inches.
Yeah. And that's quite enough. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And then as far as Munich, what impressed me from the moment we entered Perlach or Forest Housing Area was it looked like a park. Trees, green grass. It was gorgeous. And it still is from what I see on Google Maps, because every once in a while I do go look around and go, oh, I'm not there. Poor me. And so over 3 assignments, we lived there for 7 years and I still miss that.
So most of your adulthood then after the military, obviously, was being a military spouse. I was wondering, your mom being a military spouse too, what do you think, what were some changes, do you think, looking at how your mom was as a spouse and how your spouse experience was, anything striking about the differences?
I think the biggest one was the decline in what the wife does goes on the yearly evaluation report sort of thing, because apparently that used to be a thing. And it hasn't disappeared entirely because rank still has its privileges, but the formality of maintaining a British Raj sort of environment with all the social niceties and, and well, not that we're all barbarians or anything, but just, this formality, that seems to have decreased. And along with the acceptance of wives working. In post-World War II America, there was still the aftermath of absorbing all the men back into the civilian jobs. So unless a woman was a nurse or a teacher, the pink collar jobs, she usually didn't work for pay. Now, volunteering wasn't for pay, so that was acceptable.
Okay.
And I even have a scan of a news clipping from the base newspaper in E Pluribus Unum of my mom receiving her award for 1500 hours of volunteer time in the base family services office. And she was also active in the NCO Club Wives. She was my scout leader and she was in the Red Cross Gray Ladies. Now, if all that had been paid employment, we'd have been a lot better off.
Yeah. Wow. And was your mom expected then to also entertain and to host teas and things like that?
She didn't do that as much. I think the volunteering filled in. Mm-hmm. The one big thing that I remember is Tupperware parties.
Oh, yeah. 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 I've been to a couple of those.
Yeah. Well, that first one I ever saw was a really big deal. All the ladies were dressed up. We kids were outside. I mean, this was a big deal. And we were staring in the neighbor's picture window and mm-hmm. watching all our moms do these games. And also, it was really something.
Wow. So I know we mentioned that your mom also served in the military. She was a WAC. What did she do in the war?
If you asked her, she said, "I ironed my captain's pants."
Seriously?
Seriously. She was, I think, in the mailroom. And whenever the captain had to go someplace, he needed his pants ironed, and she did it.
Wow. Okay, but she my mind is blown. Okay, but she worked in the mail room.
This was when she was in China. She was stationed in China just before the communists made their way to, at the time it was Beijing. Then it was, no, Beijing and Peking, and now it's Beijing. So she was stationed there. And then once she was back in the States, I guess she was just a clerk typist wherever she was.
Wow.
That was the job.
So now I'm curious. So like, where did your mom grow up?
Minnesota.
So she went from Minnesota to China. That's amazing. You know, I mean, imagine that.
Yeah, she grew up on a farm in Minnesota.
Well, okay. By the time you joined, I'm sure things had changed a lot. You weren't expected to iron your captain's pants.
No.
But what kind of restrictions did you, and even your mom, what kind of restrictions did you guys face as women in the military?
I suppose the biggest difference from the men at the time concerned marriage and parenthood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Women weren't allowed to do that. Mm. For my mom, she couldn't be married without permission from her command. And now earlier in the 1930s, and this was before women were in the service, Dad said that although enlisted men could be married, they had to maintain a presence in the barracks and stand all inspections. So that had eased for the men. Of course, the change to a career military, rather than just these guys that came in and went out, had something to do with that. Because I can't imagine everyone in housing needing to keep a barracks room. That would have been ridiculous.
Yeah.
But another big difference for women was that neither my mom nor I could be a parent. And that has obviously changed.
Right.
So the jobs that a woman could qualify for has always been a thorny question. I can remember in one of my mom's scrapbooks, there was letters to the editor in the China Stars and Stripes, and it was complaining about some of the women. So that has always been there. And now the jobs that are still kind of thorny are the combat arms jobs for women.
Mm-hmm.
And women want to be in these jobs because they're a more direct path to higher rank, at least in the Army. I don't remember what the Air Force's area was, probably jet mechanics or something like that, or pilots, which women are now in. But you can see a 2020 report, Women in Combat, 5-year status update, is available from the think tank Center for a New American Security. Mm-hmm. And they go over a lot of that.
Interesting. Wow. I could just end this interview right there. I mean, the whole ironing pants just blew me away. So what's so fascinating about this book, E Pluribus Unum, is that we have stories and comments going back to pre-World War II, you know, telling the good, the bad, and the ugly about military life and some of the differences and similarities and you know, kind of the, and, you know, and some of the stories are written by anonymous sources, and those are especially poignant, you know. You know, I'm always encouraging people to write down their story and tell their history, but some of the more, some of the stories in our book, E Pluribus Unum, are really poignant. And these are stories that have to be told, but aren't easy to tell, and they're not easy to read. And so, like it or not, the experiences that we share in the book, a lot of them are funny and great, but some of them are not. They tell all aspects of military life, for better or for worse.
Yeah, that doesn't get out much. Most people, when they talk about the military, it's all about valor and things like that. But like the civilian world, from which many service members still come, the general troubles that affect the civilian world are brought in to the military sphere.
Right.
The usual crimes show up, theft. My dad was especially hot under the collar about barracks thieves. I don't know what was in his past to do this, but he was, that was a topic.
Wow.
And assault and battery, people getting beat up, all the way up to murder. There's been a lot of that, unfortunately, lately. And obviously, if you just watch Law and Order, these crimes aren't specific to military life, but they right. show up there.
Right.
And for women, the worse is complicated by attitudes concerning military life, a male-dominated sphere, and the physicalness required of parts of that life. Fitting in there requires the woman to lose some of the aspects of what the civilian culture sees as a woman's proper role. And although even there, that has expanded far beyond how it used to be.
Well, so moving on to the better side of military and family life, we have a new project out, the museum does. It's our latest project, Host Nation Hospitality, of which you were a humongous part. You did a fair amount of writing for it and a lot of editing. Tell us, share that, a little bit about Host Nation Hospitality.
I found that a really fun project. For me, it was an extended trip down memory lane with all sorts of new stories.
Yeah.
From people who kind of like the pants thing for you, you know, people who'd lived in cultures I'd never experienced, as well as reminders of places I'd been. So I really enjoyed working on that.
Well, it does have a bunch of stories ranging from funny all the way up to fiascos. And there's some really sad stories in there, I have to say. Was there one story that stuck out to you as you were editing?
For me, that has to be the Point Alpha essay by Johannes Schneider. Huh. My husband was assigned to a unit that did a lot of liaison with the Border Ops Office of the 11th Armored Cav at Downs Barracks. And excuse me, this dry air has my voice just really croaky. And although we lived in Fulda for only 2 years, the experience takes up so much more space in my memory than even the longer assignments, because it was so intense
right
along the East German border. And in addition to working with border ops, my husband's office did liaison with German government entities from the local residency offices, such as the Einwohner Meldeamt, for checking on new local national employees with the various military units that use them. mm-hmm. Anna to liaison with Emma Day, the Militärische Abschirmdienst, with the Bundeswehr. That's the German Federal Military Counterintelligence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I heard that a lot. Emma Day was doing this. We're going up to Kassel or Gießen or something like that. And it heard a lot of it. Didn't do anything, but I heard a lot.
Well, you know, my husband was in the cab too with the 3rd of the 11th ACR in Bad Hersfeld. So
right.
I know exactly what you're talking about when you're talking about, you know, Point Alpha. He went to OP India and OP Romeo.
So, right.
Yeah. So that was the one that stuck out for you because it brought you back down memory lane yourself. That's cool. Yes. That's cool. You know, I thought your piece was kind of cool. I liked, there were a bunch that just, you know, spoke to me, but I thought yours was interesting when you were describing the houses, roofs, the roofs of the houses in Bermuda. Did you know about that when you were living there, or did you learn that later on or Google it, or tell us about the roofs in Bermuda?
When we got there, we kids learned about that instantly because Dad said, don't drink the water. And we lived off base initially, and the house, like all the Bermudian homes, collects rainwater in the cistern beneath the house. There's no fresh water mm-hmm. on the island. Mm-hmm. And so it's all rain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the ultimate water in the basement situation. And now, like I said, the Americans were warned to boil their water because we weren't accustomed to all the natural stuff that mm-hmm. was in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that stuff came from fish, because fish lived in the water under your house to keep down the bugs.
Wait a second. No, hold on a second though. Just I'm having an issue. Like, was there like a well in your basement or like a big pot of water that just sort of...
It was the basement.
Okay.
Pretend there's a basement underneath your house and it's full of water.
Oh, the whole, ooh.
The whole thing.
Huh. Okay. So, and then you have fish swimming around in there. So
oh, yeah.
If you wanted yeah. water, you turned on the tap and water from the basement came into your tap, or did you have to carry buckets up the stairs?
No, it was normal taps. Yeah. And so Mom would boil them and then or boil the water and then keep it in the fridge. And that was the way it worked.
Wow.
Now, when we first got there, my brother and I were curious, you know, do we really have water under our house?
Mm-hmm.
And so we probably weren't supposed to do this, but then we did a lot of things we weren't supposed to do. And there was a kind of a port sort of thing, maybe 2 feet by 2 feet with the lid. Well, mm-hmm. we pulled that up and we looked down in there, and sure enough, there was water and fish.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Wow. So that's really cool.
Yeah. And that's how it works there. Now, they do have desalination plants mm-hmm. for times during droughts or if your tank just runs dry, but you have to buy that water. So, but in the States, you have to buy your water anyhow.
Yeah.
So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I remember living in Puerto Rico. We collected rainwater in barrels for emergencies, like, you know, to flush the toilet in case the hurricane, you know.
Right.
Well, we had a babysitter who we lost water, and she thought, okay, well, this is an emergency. So she made the kids lunch with this rain barrel water. And yeah, both kids were kind of ill after that.
Yeah. My sister drank the tap water once.
Yeah.
She did. And after she drank it, she did not tell my mom that she had drunk the water, but she said she pooped green for a week.
Oh, dear. So I know your time with the museum is almost up, you know, and you're moving on to pursue your own writing projects. You've spent 2 years with us, and it's been it's been great for us. I have no idea if it was great for you, but we have really enjoyed your writing and your talents and your attention to detail. I mean, with this editing of this new book, it's been pretty it's thorough and it's been wonderful. So I'm really sad to see you moving on, but you are moving on to pursue bigger writing projects. So what are you working on right now?
My main project is a book or more featuring an American military counterintelligence agent in Germany, a woman. And so the setting is going to be the border resident office, like where my husband worked, but not exactly. I'm making a fictional town farther down in Hesse. And because I lived in Germany for about 18 years, and this was during the Cold War and in the immediate post-Cold War years with the collapse of the Warsaw Pact, there's something about the adventure of that time that I miss. Mm-hmm. And so this book is my way of capturing that history. And then for lighter times, I'm hoping for some short stories set in Bermuda, but contemporary rather than historical. And I hope these are lighthearted and fun. But since I can't afford to live in Bermuda, it is one of the most expensive places to live because everything has to be imported. Mm. And if you're not Bermudian, your taxes and everything are higher. Mm. So there's no way I can live there. So this will be my way of still being in Bermuda.
Vicariously living there.
Yes.
Yeah. In the few minutes we have left, could you just free associate with me, share a quick lesson you learned from each stage of your military life? Brat, service member, spouse, mom. Go.
Okay, brat, don't get your dad in trouble.
Okay.
Ever. Service member, do as you're told now, regardless of what you were told before.
Okay.
Spouse, don't hang any more pictures on the walls than necessary.
Mm.
And as a mom, the anxiety when your child goes into war is worse than anything from your own service or even that of your spouse.
Yeah, I agree with that one. When my kid went off to Iraq, it was, well, this is a perfect way to end this podcast with those life lessons. I imagine a lot of people will say, yep, she nailed them. I want to thank you for coming on today to talk to us. And I also wanted to let our listeners know that Host Nation Hospitality should be out on Amazon in mid-November. So stay tuned. We'll make a big announcement. It is in its final formatting and editing. Valerie looked at it, my dad looked at it, I looked at it, and now I'm going back and looking again. So there'll still be little mistakes here and there, but hopefully not.
There always are.
Hopefully not many. So just everybody stay tuned for that. The New Mexico Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities helped grant fund this project, the E Pluribus Unum project, and the McCune Foundation provided an honorarium for our Navy brat artist, Brandon Palma. We just did a podcast with him earlier this week, and it's a video podcast because he's an artist and he showed a lot of his art. So the McCune Foundation provided us an honorarium for us to pay him to do some beautiful work for this project. So anyone who is curious about this, you could definitely buy it. We'll put the link in the comments. Thank you all for listening today. And I wanted to thank Valerie once again. The museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brat Seal and Military Brats Registry. So bye, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
See you later. And it was great working with the museum. I enjoyed my time very much.
Thank you, Valerie.